Well, I want to invite you to go ahead and turn with me to Job chapter 32. And as you're doing that, I thought as a way of introducing where we're headed now in this next section, if you would kind of participate in an informal demographic survey of the class, if you wouldn't mind, and again, I'm trying to use ranges here that are protecting the innocent, if you will, but if you wouldn't mind raising your hand if you are under age 30. Can everybody look around? Under age 30. All right. If you raise your hand if you are between the ages of 30 and 50, so over 30 but under 50. Okay. Everybody see that? All right. Now, if you are over age 50 but under age 65, raise your hand. Now, this is where we got to make sure everybody's being honest. Are you being honest? We need to check IDs. All right, now how about over 65? This is an awesome survey. I bring this up because I think that this should be a great encouragement to all of us. There is an absolute necessity. I can't overstate this. There's an absolute necessity within the body of Christ that there be ongoing, regular, fruitful engagement between young and old. In meaningful ways. In substantive ways. In formulating genuine bonds of fellowship and relationship. And to just see that there is the demographic makeup, even in this small representation of the larger local fellowship here, is a great encouragement, but it also presents to us a great responsibility that we are very active in that type of engagement, mutually. The burden falls to all of us, in fact. We come to chapter 32, and just to give you a little bit of a maybe a little bit of a hint of what this next section kind of leads us to. One of the titles, it's almost like a Shel Silverstein, the children's author. Is that the right guy? The Cat in the Hat and all that, right? Or no? Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss. Well, Shel Silverstein also had those poetic things, right? But Dr. Seuss is someone I came to mind because I had this title. I'm not going to make this the title. So if you're looking for this on the recording later on, it's not what the title is going to be. But I thought about the title, what to do with this young man Elihu. Because that's really where I arrive when I think about what we see here in these next several chapters. In fact, listen to one of the commentators that I often refer to, Francis Anderson. Listen to what he says about this new character in our study of Job and this narrative about Elihu. He says, hitherto, up to this point, Elihu had held back out of respect for their age, the age of the others, Job and his three friends. Now, he joins in with a combination of deference and cocksuredness that captures the pose of youth that sees a little, but sees it clearly. I want to say that again so we don't get lost in some of the phraseology there. He's talking about what is about to transpire with these speeches of this young man, Elihu. And he makes the comment that up to this point, this young man, Elihu, has held back out of respect for the age of these other men, Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But now, he joins in with a combination of deference and cocksuredness that captures the pose of youth that sees little, but sees it clearly. I kept thinking about this principle, this sort of reality, even among us and that we experience in as life, as we're growing up, as we're maturing, as we're interacting with various people from various sort of age groups and seasons of life. I had this picture in my mind of You know, you've seen this before. You probably have seen it recently, I'm guessing. There's probably been some incident in college football or whatever lately, but where you have a sort of an athletic competition of some sort, let's just call it a football game or a basketball game or something, where you've got young athletes on the court or on the field, and you've got a coach or a parent who is observing one of these young athletes, and they are performing or executing improperly. They are not doing something correctly. They're engaging in the athletic endeavor, but they're not executing according to form or the way that they've been taught or what is the most effective or efficient way to defend or to tackle or to whatever it might be. And that parent or that coach just loses it. And they're seeing this happen and they're just looking at it and they're going, they can't believe that this young athlete is making this kind of mistake. But the reality is if that coach or that parent tried to execute like the athlete, an ambulance would have to be dispatched immediately. They would pull something or break something or fall out from exhaustion immediately. There's this tension that's sort of built in to the dynamic and interaction and relationship between young and old. There are the older who have seen more, who have perspective, can maybe look at a particular situation or scene, and they can see what's really going wrong, what's being done wrong, what needs to be corrected or tweaked, what angles need to be taken that aren't being taken. And they can see it, but they can't necessarily execute on it themselves anymore. They can't step in and make this younger person see what they see and know what they know. And yet the response can often be one of impatience, frustration, irritation at their lack of execution or performance. Meanwhile, what's also happening on using that same field or athletic analogy, what's also happening is many, 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 many repetitions or plays or moves, whatever you want to say, that are being done flawlessly with a level of skill and precision and athleticism that this elder statesman, coach, or parent couldn't even think of possibly performing. And there's a lack of appreciation, possibly, for what is actually taking place, what can actually be seen in this young person. Well, we have this young man, Elihu, being introduced to us here. Just to kind of give us a little recounting of where we've been. The last time we were together, we covered the three chapters that make up Job's final summation. Chapters, 29 to 31? Where Job is basically going through a series of speeches or a lengthy dialogue or lengthy monologue, I should say, where he's looking back at the beginning. He's looking back with a little bit of nostalgia for the previous heights of blessedness that he had occupied, the blessing and righteousness of God that was his, and he was experiencing the unmatched blessing of God and the closeness and nearness of fellowship with God and friendship with God, and had a sense of God's affirmation and protection. He was blessed by family life that was rich and full. He had an unrivaled reputation in his community, so he, as an older, accomplished man, was also receiving the blessing and benediction of all those in his community. Whether it was young or old, they would look upon him as someone who was to be esteemed and honored. His words were like wise drippings that you just, morsels that you just wanted to take. I mean, there's this vivid imagery that is employed in this section of Job where his whole experience in the past was one of blessing and the benediction of God. And then he moves into, in chapter 30, this very graphic depiction of the current circumstances, of the current depths of his suffering and despair, where he's He's on the receiving end of all kinds of derision and scorn from the very people that he had helped when he was in his more blessed state, in his more wealthy state, in his more capable state, in his more healthy time. He was on the receiving end of an excessive degree of cruelty and debasement. He was also suffering, as we all know, from this emotional and this physical torment that was just relentless and came at him in wave after wave of pain and sadness and despair. And then also, we noted how he was suffering from an excruciating sense of spiritual isolation and fear and despair. He sensed the absence of this great loving God that once was so near to him. And there was this excruciating pain associated with that, this isolation that was associated with this sense of separation from God. And then in chapter 31, we saw Job making this impassioned appeal for justice and vindication. That's where he goes to at the end of this long summation in these three chapters, using the form of what we described as negative confession, what the theologians call negative confession, these statements, these if-then statements, if I have done this or that, then let justice prevail, let judgment come upon me. And the whole point of him bringing up all these litany of sins in the form of an if-then statement is to make the point that he is not guilty of any of these things. He's so bold and so sure is he of his innocence that he's willing to sort of put it all on the line and say things like, if I have done this, then let the full wrath and judgment of God come upon me. If I am guilty of that, let his justice prevail so that I suffer under his judgment. I mean, over and over and over again in matters of sexual purity, honesty and justice, social responsibility and taking care of the needs of the poor and the widows and the orphans, idolatry, greed, interpersonal ethics, land and agriculture, stewardship of even his property, all these categories he lays out and says, if I have done wrong in any of these areas, let God's judgment befall me. And he's doing that as a way of saying, I've done none of these things. I stand innocent before God. And then the chapter ends in verses 35 to 37 of chapter 31, where he says, I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. If my land has cried out against me and its furrows have wept together, if I have eaten its yield without payment and made its owners breathe their last, let thorns grow instead of wheat and foul weeds instead of barley. And then it says, the words of Job are ended. He concludes by saying, let me have a hearing, God. Give me a hearing so that I can be vindicated. And then we turn to Job chapter 32. And we're introduced to this, as I've already mentioned, this young man, another character in the narrative here, obviously a young observer of these proceedings that have been taking place over some period of likely months between Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And this young man, Elihu, has been watching and listening carefully to everything that's transpired. And you have this transition in chapter 32, starting in verse 1. It says, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. And Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young in years and you're aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. This is where we begin with Elihu. This is where we're introduced to Elihu, this young man who is observing what's taking place. And he has something to say. In fact, The first thing you're introduced to in these first few verses is basically a profile of this man. It says in verse 4, "Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he, and when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouths of these three men, he burned with anger." He's we're beginning to get a picture from the narrator of who this young man is. Before he even speaks, we're being introduced to a bit of a profile. The first thing I would kind of point our attention to, which I think is worthy of note, is you do have a reference to his lineage, and it's actually a little bit more lengthy than you even have of the other three friends. It says that Elihu is the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram. And that Barachel, I'll probably pronounce it seven different ways before we're done if I have to keep pronouncing it. But you have these references that are more than what you see with the other men, much more of a Hebraic reference than an Edomite reference. Ram is one of the ancestors of David. You see that in Ruth chapter 4 and 1 Chronicles chapter 2. Buz is the brother of Uz, a nephew of Abraham. And remember, this is the land of Uz. This is the general region or area. And Barachel is widely understood to mean God has blessed, or blessed be God. And so it has this, what's called a theophoric name, this name with the name of God attached to it. And it definitely aligns with sort of this patriarchal era kind of nomenclature. Same with Elihu. He is my God is another way to understand Elihu's name. So you have this very Hebraic sort of patriarchal lineage that's represented by Elihu. He's someone who seems to be local to the area, even local to where Job is and local to where these proceedings are. So he's not someone necessarily who was sort of a squire tagging along with these three friends and showed up with them and just didn't happen to be mentioned because he was young and insignificant. It seems as though he was there observing all of this and in a position to be able to watch what took place and hear what took place. And then you notice that he is characterized with this, what I would just call youthful, righteous, in air quotes, anger. You have this youthful, righteous indignation or anger. It is so prominent in these first few verses. Verse 2, "Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, burned with anger." He did what? Again, he burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. But he's not done. He burned with anger at the three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Verse 4, "Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when," verse 5, "Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these men, he burned with anger." You want to know what's going on in the heart and soul of Elihu? He's burning with anger. And this is one of those typical, you know, uses of repetition to make a very clear point. This is a young man who is more inclined in youth toward a certain type of heat, a certain type of welling up quickly. And you get this picture that he's been waiting and watching and listening and getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. In fact, if you look at this text from a certain perspective, you kind of want to sympathize with the kid, with the young man. He's been holding back. There are these cultural sort of constraints that he's feeling, that he does not have the right. He's not of age. He's not of maturity. It would be a dishonor for him to speak out. Yet, meanwhile, he firmly believes that he's observing things and hearing things that warrant something to be said. And yet, he remains silent. So much so that it's almost as though there's this long pause. You know, Job sort of wraps up these three chapters of monologue, kind of summarizing all of his thoughts and ideas and experiences over this whole ordeal. And there's like this quiet pause, and it's almost as though Elihu's looking around going, you know, is anybody going to say anything? So he's characterized by this youthful, and I put righteous anger, I put righteous in air quotes, because, you know, as we'll see, everything that he says is not pure as the driven snow. But I do think that what we can ascertain in our observances of what Elihu says is that he is motivated by a certain sincerity that is in many ways constrained and even maybe diminished a little bit by his youth. But it's sincerity nonetheless. Are you thinking about and picking up on the tension that we have to live in and operate in and try to learn how to be fruitful in as we engage with one another across age ranges? I started out by talking about the necessity of this, the importance of this, the absolute crucialness of this, but there is tension and difficulty in it. Any church or congregation or any individual believer who experiences this kind of tension or some shade of it, especially those who are older, and they retreat to just being around the people that get them and get it and understand the world and know how to think about it, and it's not so much a hassle, and they just huddle around their sort of their common like-minded age range. That is not the way of the church. We need the tension. I need to be challenged by this kind of youthful, maybe a little bit unbridled, certainly in some ways unwisely and impetuously expressed righteous anger. Going back to what the commentator I read said, they see something clearly. They just don't see it all. And so because they don't see it all, our tendency is those who are older might look on the younger and dismiss them entirely instead of trying to listen and learn and shepherd and guide and set an example. We become irritated. As we move through this, I found myself irritated with Elihu, quite honestly. And there's probably a reason for that. And the reason, there's probably many reasons, and those many reasons are probably all the colors of the hair on my face. I'm one of the sort of on the older half of things, right? And I'm looking at this young guy and I'm going, who does this kid think he is? But this whole study has pressed me to think about all the ways that I can tend to think about opinions and ideas of younger people. And because they're not all comprised of comprehensive perspective that is gained through years of wisdom and faithfulness and experience and interaction with people over many, many periods of time and seasons of life, I dismiss all of it. They just don't get it. One day they'll understand. And I just don't think that that's what we should take away from this passage, and nor should, do I think should be characteristic of our fellowship in any way. There are some very real challenges here, as I said. This matter of anger, this matter of passion is real, and it does produce a certain amount of potential harm. But this is not something in our fellowship and in our fellowship with one another as fellow believers. It's not something that should be outright dismissed. For Elihu, there is definitely a need for more maturity and more restraint. But he's not needing to be completely dismissed because he's suffering under the weight of youthful passion and conviction. That's what you see here in this initial profile. I mean, it's almost like this is his social media profile. My name's Elihu, and this is my family, and I'm angry at these people. I mean, that's kind of like the summation of it. Then you get to the prologue. The prologue of all that he is going to say. And this is another one of those observations that you could make about Elihu. He certainly has a lot to say. He certainly has been keeping things bottled up. We'll even see by his own description. He has many words to share. And the fact of the matter is that the prologue, so before, it's kind of like me, you know, sometimes I'll do an introduction and the class will be almost over and I haven't even started the actual lesson. This is what's happening with Elihu. This long prologue, it's like, what are you ever going to say what you're going to say? Or are you just going to introduce and caveat your way into what you're going to say? So you have this lengthy prologue from chapter 32, verse 6, all the way through chapter 33, verse 8. So basically the content of what would be an entire chapter plus. Let's look at this together. Let's read verses 6 of chapter 32 all the way through chapter 8 of verse 33 to get a sense of this. So it says in verse 6, "And Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite, answered and said, 'I am young in years and you are aged. Therefore I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, "Let days speak, and many years teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It is not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what is right.'" Now, can you imagine being the old dudes in the room hearing that? He's basically saying that being old or being of years is not necessarily the equation for wisdom. There's more to wisdom, in other words, than just being the oldest person in the room. And that is true. He's making the statement that I've been given life and breath by God Almighty. Why can't I have something to say? I've been holding back, but I'm realizing that just because these compatriots here are older doesn't mean that they're necessarily saying everything that needs to be said and uttering wisdom in the ways that it needs to be uttered. He goes on in verse 10. He says, "Therefore I say, listen to me, let me also declare my opinion. Behold, I waited for your words. I listened for your wise sayings while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words." He's basically calling him out. I've been sitting here waiting and waiting and waiting for one of you guys to pull out the winning ticket, to silence Job with your penetrating and unassailable arguments against him, and none of you have stepped up. It's left to me now. He says, "I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words." Verse 13, "Beware lest you say, 'We have found wisdom. God may vanquish him, not a man. He has not discredited his words against me, and I will not answer him with your speeches.' They are dismayed. They answer no more. They have not a word to say." He's just kind of lamenting and in some ways maybe even mocking these men who have just fallen silent. And shall I wait because they do not speak, verse 16, because they stand there and answer no more? I also will answer with my share. I also will declare my opinion, for I am full of words. Boy, is he. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. It's become painful to him to not speak. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward any person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my maker would soon take me away. Now listen, I'm going to pause right there for 1 minute. I want you to think about this in a little bit of a different, from a different perspective. There is a tendency, I believe, when we are younger, to mischaracterize the intentions of those who are older. And I believe that this is a little bit of what we're seeing here from Elihu. It's as though Elihu is basically saying, listen, I'm timid. I was timid initially. I still have a little bit of fear about speaking out, but I'm going to speak plainly. I'm just warning you. I'm going to speak plainly. And it's almost like a sideways insult to Job's three friends by saying, I'm not going to engage in flattery. I don't even know how to flatter. It's not even in my makeup or my DNA. And I would not want the Lord God to hear me using flattery instead of just speaking the direct and plain truth. Now, the reason why I bring this up as a possible mischaracterization is I personally have experienced this myself. I've been in situations where I'm observing a particular interaction and my thoughts are like, stop beating around the bush with this person. Get to it. Get in their grill. Like, I've been the one who's like, what are we doing? What are we doing beating around, flattering this person and trying to make them feel good about it? They need to be confronted. Well, that kind of tendency is, I think, all the more prevalent, possibly prevalent when we're younger, especially if it's prevalent when we're older. It can be more prevalent when we're younger and have less restraint in these ways. And we mischaracterize something that someone maybe older and wiser might be trying to do, and that is earn trust. Engage in sympathy. Use kind words that turn away wrath instead of harsh words that pierce like a sword. Maybe what I'm witnessing here is wisdom on display, not flattery. Not something that would diminish this older person's approach by accusing them of just engaging in a big waste of time and flattering this person that needs to be confronted. But here's Elihu just basically kind of giving them a warning shot. It's coming. Here it comes. I'm about to get serious, and it's going to be direct. I'm not going to show partiality. I've waited patiently. I've been respectful of my elders, but I can't do that any longer. Things need to be said. And I'm about to say them, and I'm about to say them in an unvarnished way. In verse 33, he continues, "But now, hear my speech, O Job." I'm like, get on with it. He keeps talking about he's about to say something, and he says again, "I'm about to say something." "And listen to all my words. Behold, I open my mouth. The tongue in my mouth speaks. My words declare the uprightness of my heart, and what my lips know, they speak sincerely." Have you noticed that he's talking about speaking, but he's not saying anything yet? "The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me if you can. Set your words in order before me. Take your stand." I mean, imagine, I'd best be sitting there going, come on. I mean, really? He's like, here it comes. I'm about to say something. It's coming. No, seriously, it's coming. "Behold," he says, verse 6, "I am toward God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. I'm just one of you, Job. I'm just like you. Behold, no fear of me need terrify you. My pressure will not be heavy upon you." He's pretty bold, right? Don't worry. I'm going to be direct, but you don't need to be scared, Job. You don't need to fear what's coming. "Surely you have spoken," verse 8, "in my ears, and I have heard the sound of your words." This is the prologue. It begins with this youthful timidity, but you can see clearly it's giving way to this youthful passion and this youthful conviction that is sort of undergirded by a conviction and even an anger, as the writer describes it. Now, again, I bring up the fact that I read this, and even in my own way of presenting this to us, I'm kind of mocking him, right? I'm kind of like pointing to what I see are some of the deficiencies in this young man. I mean, he already acknowledged at the beginning he's feeling timid. He's feeling a little bit fearful. He knows that he's among older men. And so he's not wanting to be aggressively dishonoring to them. And yet he's got this passion that's burning in him. He's listened and listened and listened, and no one's dealt the final blow to Job to get him to come to his senses. No one's been able to do this. He thinks that he can, and yet he's been timid. He's been fearful. But now that fear and timidity is giving way to this passion and this conviction and even this anger. And yet there's still this sense of of unassuredness. I think that's why the narrative kind of puts it as him going on and on and on before he gets to what he's going to say. He's still young. He's still aware that he's about to say things to someone who's older, to several people who are older. He goes after all of them. And so there's this anxiousness and this timidity. And I almost wonder, you know, because Job doesn't respond to him. There's no response from Job. I almost wonder, I like to think that Job's just kind of letting him do his thing. Maybe even with a certain degree of wise patience with this young man. Just bring it on. That's fine. I mean, he's probably thinking, listen, there's nothing you could say to me at this point that I haven't heard already. I'm at a point where, you know, in reality, Elihu, in reality, Eliphaz, in reality, Bildad, in reality, Zophar, you can't possibly fathom what I'm experiencing. That's what we know to be true, right? As those who have been able to sort of come into the narrative and get behind the curtain in the council room of God himself to see how this whole thing began with sort of a challenge from Satan and God declaring Job as a righteous and upright man and someone who would be faithful to him. Satan knowing that if he only had a chance to touch him, to affect him, to have the protection of God and the blessing of God removed, he knows that Job is really a fraud and would deny God and would not be proven faithful. I mean, that's how this whole thing begins. And we have visibility into that, but Job and these other guys don't. And so here Job is listening to him say these things, and there's really nothing that can be said to Job at this point that would affect him, that would hurt him, that would cause him to tremble in fear. So you see this blend of timidity and fear with passion. It's kind of a recipe for something less than a fruitful monologue. But nevertheless, this is the prologue of what we see in these speeches from Elihu. And this is why we need to be in continuous engagement, young and old together. We need to be able to understand these things. We need to be able to see these tension points play out on a more regular basis so that we're familiar with them, so that we don't react and respond to one another in ways that are unfruitful. We need to become familiar with the passions and the convictions where young people are beginning to understand the truth of God's word and its implications for their lives and the sense of calling, and that it raises up in them passion and conviction. And yet what you can also see is an extending out of application of that knowledge in ways that are unwise, right? Calling people out, being quick to judge, being impatient with people. But we need to understand that oftentimes that's coming from a place of sincere and growing conviction that is not fully tempered with the maturity of age and years and experience, but it's still sincere conviction. And we, as those who might be on the older side of the equation, need to be able to appreciate that and help them mature, not be dismissive. We need to be familiar with it. We need to be able to hear the rhythms of that kind of communication so that we're not just reacting to it and being dismissive. That's why the engagement, I think, is so important. The ongoing engagement is so important. And I think that there's obligation on the part of the young people, too, to recognize their own tendency in these directions. And actually, when they feel like they're being dismissed, to work hard at not taking things too personally and to recognize that the Lord is using all of this to mature them as well. Well, that's the prologue. Now we get to Elihu's process. I call this Elihu's process because it's different. His engagement, his debate process is different than what we saw from the other three men. You may recall on numerous occasions I've made the point as we've kind of walked through these cycles of speeches between Bildad and his three friends that came to visit him initially, and how there was this ongoing challenge for us because the point-counterpoint communication between, for example, Eliphaz and then Job's response, or Bildad and then Job's response, they weren't linear in nature. It's very difficult to see, okay, what is actually Job responding to right now? Who is he responding to? I mean, I know that Bildad just said these things, but it doesn't look like Job is directly responding to the things that Bildad just said. And so there's this more loose, structure of the debates between Job and his three friends. Eliphaz comes along, though, and he has a much more, you might say, direct and linear and maybe in some ways a more disciplined approach or process. He on numerous occasions throughout these speeches, he restates what Job has said, or he paraphrases or kind of states by inference what Job has indicated or said, and then he refutes it. So it's kind of a little bit easier to follow. This is what he's responding to. This is what his problem is. This is what he's upset about with Job. So you see this illustrated right here in the beginning in chapter 33, verses 9 to 13. He says in verse 9, "You say," he's talking about what Job has said, "you say, I am pure, without transgression. I am clean, and there is no iniquity in me. Behold, he finds occasions against me." Behold, he is a reference to Job speaking about God. "Behold, he," God, "finds occasions against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. Behold, in this you are not right." Now Elihu is responding in verse 12. "Behold, Job, in this," these things I just quoted or referred to that you had said previously, "behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying, he will answer none of man's words?" So this is Elihu basically restating something that Job said, or paraphrasing it at least, and then beginning to attempt to refute it. And this is probably what is at the heart of his frustration with the three friends. He's looking at them and he's saying, you're not going after these things specifically and pointedly. And so I'm going to do this. Let me show you how to do this. So you have, first of all, him going after Job's repeated claims of innocence, coupled with Job's claims of God's hostility toward him. In other words, in the scheme of God's justice, this does not add up. Job's claims of innocence and God persisting in his hostility toward him does not make sense in their worldview and understanding of God's justice. If I'm innocent, I should not be suffering. That's the equation. I am suffering in the midst of my innocence. God remains hostile toward me. Something is amiss. For Job's three friends, it is Job declaring that God is not just. Anathema. How dare he? To Elihu, the very same. To Job, who's the one under this suffering and who knows that he is not guilty of any protracted or persistent lifestyle or habit of sin, but yet he's suffering. And yet all this time he has had the same doctrine, the same theology, that this is how God's justice works. You live a life of sinfulness and you suffer his wrath under pain of suffering in this life. God is retributive in his justice. He comes after you when you sin. It's a linear relationship. That's how God works. And yet Job is going, I've always thought that's how God works, but I'm innocent and yet I'm suffering in this way. This doesn't make sense. So you have these three friends and now Elihu who are struggling with this whole concept. And to Elihu now, for Job to claim innocence in the midst of God's hostility against him is to declare that God is not just. In chapter 9, verses 21 to 22, Job says, "I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe myself. It is all one. Therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked." Job said that, speaking of God. I mean, obviously, what other conclusion can I come to, Job is saying. I'm innocent, I'm suffering, I'm near destruction. My flesh is falling off my body. I've lost everything. And yet I'm blameless. So it must be that God destroys both the blameless and the wicked. Chapter 10, verse 7. Speaking of God, Job says, although you know that I am not guilty and there is none to deliver out of your hand. So he even makes the statement that God knows that he's innocent. Which, by the way, if we, by the privilege that we have from our perspective, go back to chapter 1 and 2, what do we know to be true? He is innocent. It is true. God knows him to be innocent. The whole purpose of this is different than what these men assume. Chapter 13, verses 23 to 24. Job says, how many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? That's a direct correlation with what Elihu quoted. Again, chapter 16, verse 9. Job, speaking of God, he has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He has gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. This is Job just trying to work out, what is this that I'm going through? And what does this mean about God? What does this say about God? Clearly, it's not what I always thought it was. But I have no idea how to make sense of this. This is Job over and over again throughout this entire narrative, crying out and grappling with the justice of God in all of this. The nature of God, the character of God. And as we saw routinely, he would come back to, yet I will hope in him, fighting for faithfulness. I believe that my Redeemer lives and I will see him. So you have these injections of Job of faith and hope in a Redeemer that will save him. But here, what Elihu is pointing to is clear. Job said these things. And so this is what he's going to respond to. There are other examples in Job chapter 34. Several examples in Job chapter 34 where Elihu says, for Job has said, I am in the right, and God has taken away my right. In spite of my right, I am counted a liar. My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. This is him referring back to something Job said in chapter 27. Or you could even refer to chapter 9, verse 20 to 21. In Job chapter 34, verse 9, Elihu quoting Job, for he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight. So over and over again, my point is this, again in chapter 35, verses 2 and 3, do you think this to be just? Do you say, speaking of Job, my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage have you? How am I better off than if I had sinned? These are direct references to things that Job had said. The point here is that Elihu is taking a very linear and direct approach, citing Job and then seeking to refute what Job has said. So that's Elihu's process. Now let's talk for a moment. Maybe we'll wrap up with this and pick it up next week. Let's look at Elihu's point. What is Elihu's main thesis? Well, I would just summarize it like this. And you find it summarized in chapter 33, verses 14 to 30. Elihu's main point is that God speaks in the depths of our slumber or our sleep and in our suffering to mercifully warn us of our wayward pride and to redeem us from the pit of destruction and restore us to righteousness and vitality. That's a mouthful, I get it. To summarize what I just said, Elihu's main thesis is that God is using suffering for a corrective and redemptive purpose. That's his emphasis. The emphasis of Job's other three friends was that, Job, you have obviously sinned. You need to repent so that you can be restored. Over and over and over again. Job, how can you say these things? You've obviously sinned. But Elihu is actually touching on what is a true principle of God's purposes in broad strokes. God does, in the depths of our souls, You do know that there's no such thing as an actual atheist, right? I mean, there are people who say they don't believe in God, but there's no such thing as an actual atheist. Scripture tells us this in Romans, for example, that what's going on in the life of someone who denies God is that they have suppressed the truth that they know about God. They've suppressed the truth in unrighteousness. So there is no atheist. But what I can tell you that every person, if they were honest, or if we could strip away the veil of their physical frame and actually look into the experiences of their heart and their mind and their soul, we would be able to see those pictures and those occasions where in the depths of night, in the darkness and quietness of solitude and sleep, that God pressed in on them and made them aware of their need, of their lostness, of their despair, of their sin. These are warning signs. These are warning communications from God that He speaks to all men, that He makes Himself known in the quietness and in the depths of solitude. Every person has experienced that. Whether they acknowledge it or whether they're perceptive to it or not, they have. And this is what Elihu is speaking to. That God speaks in these ways. He's responding, and He's responding, we'll talk about this more next time, He's responding in accurate application, but nonetheless, He's responding to Job's claims that God is silent. God is silent. That's what He's responding to, and He's like, no, God is not silent. He speaks to you in the depths of slumber, and He is speaking through your suffering. And it is a message of mercy to return to faithfulness, to deny your waywardness and pride. And it is oriented toward redeeming you from the pit of destruction and to restore you to righteousness and to vitality of life. Listen to this in chapter 33, verses 14 to 30. We'll read this and then we'll close in prayer and we'll pick this up next week. He says, "For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream and a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men while they slumber on their beds. Then He opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings, that He may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. Man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit, and his life to those who bring death. If there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand to declare to a man what is right for him, and he is merciful to him and says, 'Deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor.' Then man prays to God and He accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy and He restores to the man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, 'I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light.' Behold, God does all these things twice, three times with the man to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be lighted with the light of life." This is Elihu actually kind of having a sense of understanding and articulating the gospel in pretty clear terms. He's just misapplying principles to Job that he's unaware of. We'll continue with this next week. Let's close in prayer.